Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, welcome to Nature Now for the final week of May with Mary Robson and Alex Henley. This state is in its ninth week of shutdown due to COVID-19. And obviously changes are ahead, but the return to familiar patterns of life will be slow. Today, however, we will continue to celebrate the natural world and its comfort. And we're going to start with Alex telling us a bit more about butterflies.
Butterflies and bees choose warm, sunny days to emerge. Seen near Discovery Bay this week, an adult tiger swallowtail butterfly, bright yellow with black wing borders and stripes. These are the most common large butterflies seen locally. They lay eggs in big leaf maples, willow, aspen, and cottonwood, leaving one egg singly on a leaf. Tiger swallowtail's nectar on a range of flowers, including blackberry, yarrow, lilac, and rhododendron. They are common in part because they use many different plants. Tiger swallowtails resemble monarch butterflies, though monarch butterflies seldom appear on the Olympic Peninsula. The primary reason is the absence of milkweed. Monarchs use milkweed as their primary host. They prefer native milkweed, Asclepias speciosa. If you might be planning to add milkweed to a garden, be sure to look for this species. Any hybrid types of milkweed are attractive to people but not useful for monarchs. For support on butterfly knowledge, you can get Robert Pyle's newest guidebook, Butterflies of the Pacific Northwest, from Timber Press.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about what's green and growing. The native plant growth is just abounding. Wild roses, more and more vivid salal bloom, calypso orchids near Lake Crescent, really worth seeing. This is adding to this remarkably flowery spring. Many of us have noticed plants in unusual bloom. Wendy Tweeten, one of our great correspondents, reported, "I'd never seen common paintbrush, Castilleja miniata, growing at Fort Worden before. This spring is giving us fine opportunities for walking and learning." Native plants in colonies at Fort Worden's beach are in full bloom now. Far Reaches Farm wrote about this in their nursery blog and included photos of them. The stretch of dunes between the Marine Science Center and the lighthouse are gorgeous right now with beach pea, coastal sand verbena, large-headed sedge, and Carex macrocephala. The local chamber of the Washington Native Plant Society has been working to preserve this ecosystem from destructive foot traffic. Our mystery sound. This is one of the birds that is remarkably easy to identify by its song. That's all a clue you're getting. Our interview today is with Ann Soll, who is resource manager for the city of Sequim. I met her first through her writing in the Sequim Gazette, and she was on with us when I talked with her on a snowy January day when water managers were seeing snow more positively than people driving 101. Ann is a hydrogeologist and has been on the Olympic Peninsula since 1990. She says of herself, "I realize I'm considered an old-timer by many residents, but I am still discovering new stuff every day from farmers, fishermen, and my co-workers in public works." She appears regularly in the Sequim Gazette, and she also has a website, www.watercolumnsite.wordpress.com. Hi, Ann, and welcome back.
Thanks, Mary.
Looking at summer. And I decided to start by sort of saying what I do. I'm trying to determine future summer water supply by staring at the mountains and their current snowpack. But this is so subjective. I wanted to know, it's the last week in May, and how have people checked in about the water supply? What's going on? What do we think summer is going to be like?
Well, there's a couple of things that we can look at to answer that question. First of all, I have to point out that the real old timers, especially the farmers and irrigators, they're the ones that taught me what to look for in the mountains to know if we're going to be okay by the late summer or not. They would look for a certain snow patch that looks like a heart on Baldy, which is on Gray Wolf Ridge. And then there's a cross that shows up on Blue Mountain, and you can see it from Squim. And if you don't see the cross on July 1st, then you're in trouble. You know, it's already too late. Yeah, there's some really interesting things like that. Otherwise, the data that's collected is done by the Weather Service, basically the NOAA, and then also sites in the mountains that are maintained by the National Park and other agencies, usually federal agencies, state water managers also. Of course, they all use quantitative methods to predict, and they predict both river flow as well as temperature, so they can say how quickly the snow will disappear or not.
So based on the data that's being regularly collected quantitatively, you are, as a water resource or as a resource manager and other people, are able to consider what may happen. I'm sure that the level of prediction can get a little iffy as you're going along. But I'd be interested in which agencies and websites are collecting things. I know there are measurement sites in the park largely for snow. Is that correct?
Yes. They collect snow depth and what's called snow water equivalent, as well as the overall precipitation totals. We have a situation this year where we have kind of a higher than normal amount of rain down here at this elevation, but the amount of cumulative precipitation for the water year that starts October 1st is low, is only 72% of normal. What they're saying is that we do have a potential drought declaration even in the Olympics. It's not there yet, and we are in better shape than a lot of the other watersheds in the Pacific Northwest, but the potential's there.
Well, and this leads all of us to want to learn more. I know that different communities get their water from different sources. I live near Chimicum, and I think that we're on an aquifer, but I'm not entirely sure. So I was wondering how that affects the information, because what you're going to want to do is get some real news out to people about, here's what's going on. And as we mentioned, it hasn't been regularly covered in the newspapers lately, because everybody's got their mind on something else. Yeah, what are different communities using for their sources, and what do the farmers use?
It changes radically between one end of the peninsula to the other. You're in Port Townsend, and so the city of Port Townsend and the mill are taken care of by surface water originating in the Quilcene River system. That's a surface water source, you know, which is vulnerable to snowmelt, directly vulnerable to the amount of snowmelt. Whereas most folks that aren't part of a community, a larger city, wouldn't be dealing with surface water. They'd have a well. So if you're outside of the cities, you probably have either a small water system on a well or your own private well. Of course, aquifers recharge and discharge at a much slower rate than rivers do. So they are more stable and can weather the climatic changes and the water level changes from year to year. In the long term, you would need to be watching those aquifer levels. If the water in the water table in the aquifer is declining gradually over time, that's why we have state and county resources, hopefully, that are keeping track of that and measuring water level in wells throughout the North Olympic Peninsula. Squim, in my city, we have a few well fields, which is a few, you know, several wells near each other. As well as some reliance on the river, Dungeness River. We have a 30-foot deep collection system underneath the riverbed at a high elevation, or, you know, relatively high elevation.
Okay, how was that designed, that upper level Dungeness? Is it a storage area, basically?
So in Squim, we've got a couple of sources, well fields, but we've also got it's called a rainy collector well, and it's about 30 feet deep under the riverbed, and it's where a perforated pipe lets water in, and it's basically in the gravels under the river, 30 feet under the river, lets in water at a higher rate than you would get from a drilled well that goes deeper. And so it draws water in through these perforated pipes, and then it transfers it up to the ground surface, and then it goes into a pipe into our town. So that's technically considered groundwater, not surface water. But it is related to the Dungeness system, so we don't want to be using that overly much during a drought. So we switch to our well fields when we've got low water in the river. City of Port Angeles, for example, of course, they use the Elwha River. And then out west, there are a couple small water systems, very small communities out on 112 that are reliant on surface water as well. And in fact, one of them went dry. There was a small stream that serves a small community, and it's literally been enough water for that community in the last couple of years. And the PUD has been asked to come help them. They've trucked water into that community.
That reminds me of something that I wanted to mention about availability of water. My sister has lived for 55 years on a Wyoming ranch that has no drinkable water. They bring it in 100 gallons at a time, so you can't brush your teeth or make soup without using this imported water. It really has changed my sense of what it means to be able to turn on a faucet and get a drink. Cattle can drink the water, which is alkaline, and apparently that doesn't seem to bother cattle, but it definitely bothers humans. You're feeling that the communities that might have to truck water in when their small stream source dries up in late summer, like, what, August, September, thereabout, it's not related to growth, you said, but it is related to long-term drought. So something's happening that is somewhat new in that sense.
Absolutely. I think that it is related to the warming planet. We have less moisture in our soils, less recharge going into our ground to refill the aquifers or to keep the streams flowing in that late summer period. In spite of living in the Pacific Northwest, we have real drought here, and the folks that are relying on surface water are going to be the first to feel it.
A small community might not have a whole overreaching method for dealing with this. As you said, they're asking PUD in Port Angeles or somewhere to make sure that they can get supplies brought in?
Yeah, that's what they have done. It's the Collin County government itself is actually helping out with that issue as well.
Okay.
It's the PUD has the infrastructure, the facilities in place to help take care of it, but Collin County is helping this community out as well.
But that community is essentially dealing with something that could happen in any community with water risk. So, I mean, I was thinking about the brown is the new green relating to lawns. I grew up in Ohio when everything was green in the summertime and brown in the winter, and we have it opposite. So one of the things is, are people changing their thoughts about this, particularly as climate change is a new kind of risk, or is it sort of, well, let's just see what happens and deal with it when it happens.
I live and work in a certain bubble because I'm thinking about it all the time, and the people I talk to are thinking about it more as well than the average citizen, I'm sure, just because we're in the same circles. I do see that folks, depending on where they're coming from and where their connections are, for example, immigrants or transplants from California, for example, they are 100% ready to pay attention to water supplies. And whereas I think some of the folks that are either coming from, say, Alaska or a place Pacific Northwest, if you're not from Eastern Washington, you know, you would assume that we have, what's the Emerald State, and we would always have plenty of rain.
And Seattle is the Emerald City for sure. But I worked for almost 25 years with WSU teaching horticulture. And one of the hardest things to get across to people was no matter what you showed them, they would say, well, you know, summer's coming. We just plant that and the rain will take care of it. And in the case of where we are as humans dealing with risk right now, we're in a very bumpy state, I would say, many of us not knowing what's going to come over the next, on the next hill. But climate change is a different kind of risk, and we are not perhaps all completely settled with the fact that it is happening around us.
You know, I think that the pandemic has given us a lot to deal with risk-wise, and we're showing what we're capable of handling, new types of risk, but I do think that water is probably the most visible and tangible climate change impact to our area that we've got. It's going to hit us where it hurts. Over time, we're going to have to be dealing with water shortages because our glaciers and our snowpack is declining, and that is what supplies our water, whether it's in the ground through recharge or whether it's directly through the rivers every summer. And it is visible in the mountains if you know what you're looking at. If you've got some of those signals, what to look for on June 1st and what to look for on July 1st.
Well, so since we're approaching June 1st next week, where could a person look to get a clue? I just happened to stare at the vicinity of Hurricane Ridge from Squim, feel as if I didn't learn a whole lot. I'm thinking that one of the things that you do is you have a blog and you interpret the water year statistics up to this point. So if somebody looks at your blog, they might learn where things are projected to be on June 1st, for instance.
There are a couple places. One of my blogs was about signs of coming times, and it talks about a couple of those signs in the mountains. I don't actually know if there's a sign for June 1st, but there's definitely one for July 1st.
And the sense is that I get concerned because I think, well, I believe that I'm saving water. Maybe I'm not saving as much of it as I could be. What is the effect of one person's activity? I'm up the hill from a golf course that is mighty green right now. That is their business choice, and I understand that. But I also want to live in such a way that I am regarding water with the degree of honor that it should be getting, which means keep a bucket in the shower and catch water and slop it around outside. But I had just wondered, since the local supply varies, and since occasionally and very occasionally there might be a good splash of rain in the middle of July, for instance, the thing that I'm picking up from you is that we need to look at the broader picture rather than at individual events that just happen to come along.
Yep. Year to year, watching the data, watching the snow, and accepting that this is really happening here, and water will be limited within our lifetime. Certainly, it'll be an issue for our children. I think that the biggest uses are agriculture and anything that involves irrigation is where the vast majority of the water gets used, or industry. We don't have a lot of industry here in Squim other than farms, but I know you do
right
over there. So those numbers, don't know how they compare to agriculture.
Ultimately, it's all connected to your point about water usage will become different as time goes by in the next years.
I think water supplies will definitely be different, and I think we'll all be paying attention to it more and more over the years.
Well, I am glad that you are on the team that is going to help us pay attention. We have reached a point where we need to stop for today, but not forever. I'll look forward to having you come back. And I'm very grateful for your time and attention and the fact that you can help us learn. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Mary.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Today's mystery sound, red-winged blackbirds, a completely wonderful bird. The male is shining black and has sort of epaulettes, wing patches in red and gold. I think the male is wearing the color scheme of some sort of antique royal uniform. The female red-winged blackbird is all brown. It could be mistaken for a large sparrow, or like all the birds that some of us used to call LBJs for little brown jobs. It completely lacks the brilliance of the male. This, of course, makes it quite possible for that bird to not be noticed when it's raising its young. Red-winged blackbirds can live in the coastal Pacific Northwest through winter. Some will migrate south as far as Mexico, departing in the fall, but during spring they all seem to be here, and their songs just trill over wetlands as they perch on cattails and announce themselves over and over. This is one of the most distinctive bird sounds we hear each spring. They are easy to spot and they are a pleasure to see. Let's hear it for red-winged blackbirds. And that is our show for the last week in May 2020. We appreciate your tuning in. Thanks to Alex Henley for rigging up the phone connections and helping to keep Nature Now going. Nature Now airs on Wednesdays at 12:05, Thursdays at 5:05, and Saturdays at 12:30. And check our podcast for a great variety of shows.
Today's music is Al Green's Take Me to the River.
dedicate this song to little Junior Park. A cousin of mine is gone on, but we'd like to kind of carry on in his name by saying,